From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Every few weeks, Father Bill Terry puts on his garments and steps outside St. Anna's Episcopal Church in the Treme neighborhood in New Orleans. He's a tall man with long white hair and a beard, and he walks up to a large whiteboard attached to the front of the church building, holding a sheet of paper and a permanent marker.
And I won't need a ladder today, but I will start writing these names. Let's see, it's 2016.
Father Bill is adding names to what he calls the murder board. It's a list he's been keeping since 2007 of all the people who've been murdered in New Orleans. In neat lettering, he slowly writes down four pieces of information: the date of the incident, the name of the victim, the age, and how they were killed.
Malcolm Harris, 31, shot.
In addition to the board he's writing on today, there are three others, each about 4 feet high, 6 feet wide, hung on the cast iron fence that runs along the sidewalk. At first glance, you might not know exactly what it is, but when you look closer, the gravity of the lives lost sinks in.
And we have Renita Vaughn.
When he's finished writing the names, Father Bill prays for the victims in silence, makes the sign of the cross, and walks back inside. New Orleans is ranked among the most violent cities in the U.S., and since he started keeping track in 2007, Father Bill has put up about 1,800 names. And even though the murder rate has dipped over the past couple years, he says there's still way too many people killed in his community.
The murder board attempts to create a sense of profound loss because it's a list of names. It moves it out of a numbers game and into more of a moral, ethical fabric of humanity. And it does so without judgment. You can't tell the bad guys from the good guys on this list. That doesn't mean I don't believe in justice, but I certainly believe in the value of all human life. And this board speaks to that.
What was the catalyst for the murder board?
The catalyst was the overwhelming amount of violent crime in our city. And then there was an incident which I often reflect on. In July of 2005, my wife and I were sitting in the living room one night, and we watched the news as we did every night. And, of course, every night they were reporting another murder. And my wife turned around and asked me, where was that murder? And I said, don't worry, it wasn't in our neighborhood. That very night, we went to bed, and there was gunfire across the street, you know, pop, 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 pop. And I went running out like an idiot to see what was going on. By the time I got there, there was a young man laid out in a parking lot, and his girlfriend was half blocked down the street screaming. And believe it or not, within a minute, the police were there securing the scene. I tried a few times to approach the young man to give him last rites or at least some prayers, and I was kind of fended off by the chief detective saying that I would contaminate the crime scene, which to this very day bugs me. I think that was bull, but in any event, the whole night was surreal. And so that taught me that don't worry about it, it's not in my neighborhood, isn't good enough. And those were my words.
2 years later, Father Bill and one of his deacons came up with the idea of the murder board. And immediately, the community took notice.
Oh, I have people drive up in minivans that I'll see sometimes. They all kind of compiling out and take photographs. I've even had people go up and write names on it that I haven't gotten to yet. So it's kind of a public memorial or symbol for them. I think one lady said it best, and she met me at the church, and she said, I want to thank you for putting my son's name up there. I didn't think anybody cared about him anymore. I know what it's like to lose a child. Several years ago now, my daughter at age 19 committed suicide, and rather violently. And so I'm a parent who has survived the death of a child. And so I can have a pretty good handle on, or certainly a high degree of empathy and understanding for other surviving victims of violence, especially family members.
Can you talk a little bit about how you see guns affecting your community?
All you have to do is look at the murder board. In fact, give me 2 seconds. The names for this past week or week and a half, and I'm going to read how this list reads, and then you tell me how guns play a role. Joshua Woodruff was vehicular homicide. Myesha McDaniels, shot. Sammy Banks, 61, shot. Billy Dukes, 26, shot. Ryan Saffron, 34, shot. Rashawn Smith, shot. Malcolm Harris, shot. Renata Vaughn, stabbed. So you tell me how guns play a role in it.
Why do you think there's such a proliferation of it in your community?
How about from sea to shining sea, the proliferation of guns? I mean, it's not just this community. Almost any urban community. You go to any neighborhood that's kind of on the fringes, a little rough around the edges, you can pick up a piece for $25-$30. I mean, you know, this country is so arms-driven for personal use that it's incredible, absolutely incredible. And I own guns. I own 2 dozen guns. I love them. They're beautiful, handcrafted in some cases, some from the turn of the century. I've got a German Luger. You know, it's not that I hate guns. I hate what our country has turned guns into. You know, this symbol of freedom and a symbol of macho, and in some neighborhoods, a symbol of power and authority.
That was Father Bill Terry from St. Anna's Episcopal Church in New Orleans. The debate over guns in America is as heated as ever. Every mass shooting prompts new calls to limit access to firearms. Yet more people than ever are buying and carrying weapons for protection. We're all familiar with the battle lines. Gun rights groups, namely the National Rifle Association, make their case all the time in speeches and videos.
The Second Amendment is the most vital amendment because without it, there is no First Amendment. Because if you say that you have the right to free speech and freedom of religious expression and everything else, but you have no way to defend that right, then it's meaningless.
The NRA's argument isn't just that owning guns is a constitutional right. They say guns make all of us a lot safer. The group claims it has the research and the data to back this up. Information it's used to help pass laws making it easier to carry a gun. Now, advocates on the other side of the debate have their own research to support a different agenda. More background checks and tighter restrictions on access to guns. Now, you'd think in a country with so many guns and so much gun violence, the federal government would try to keep comprehensive data on things like how many people own guns, how many are killed or injured each day with firearms. But it doesn't. And that gets to our next story. It's about a man with his feet in both sides of the debate. He's devoting his life to documenting every incident of gun violence in America. Reveal's Michael Montgomery picks up our story in Lexington, Kentucky.
Bud's Gun Shop and Range is a long, one-story building tucked behind a shopping center just off Highway 60. It's late Wednesday morning when we catch up with Mark Bryan. He's just come from his home office where he's been gathering the latest reports on shootings from around the country. Mark walks into Bud's and flashes a silver membership card. Then he heads to a firing lane and opens a black duffel bag full of handguns.
A modern Smith & Wesson 45, a 1911 45, a Beretta 9mm like the military uses, a small 38, and we brought a large 44.
It's the heavy-duty revolver Dirty Harry made famous. Mark adjusts his feet slightly.
It's getting ready to make noise.
Okay.
And fires. His shots hit the center of the target. A paper silhouette of a person.
Interestingly, I go, when I'm frustrated with the gun violence work, I go shoot holes in paper. It gives you a focus point 25 yards away, a size of a quarter or half dollar, and everything else is in the peripheral.
Mark is a burly guy with silver hair he used to wear in a ponytail and a big, bushy beard. For years, he worked as a systems analyst for big companies like IBM. Looking at him, you can't quite tell if he's an aging hippie or a good old boy riding into the sunset.
There's probably some good old boy left in me. I've lived in New York and California and different places, so some of that is gone. But I'm from Harlan, so there's a certain level of me that's not going to change.
He's talking about Harlan County, Kentucky, where he grew up.
A lot of the fathers, after church, after lunch, would take the kids up to the garbage dump, and we would shoot rats. So I learned to shoot at about 5 years old with a .22 rifle that my father had bought back in 1937 for, I think, $13.
Mark still enjoys shooting at the range, but as he grew older, his views on guns started to change. He was hearing more stories about friends and friends of friends who were shot. Some were victims of crimes, some were accidental, others were suicides. The systems guy and Mark wanted more information. He wanted to know how many Americans were touched by gun violence. Media coverage was misleading. News crews closely followed mass shootings, but overall, far more people were killed and injured in smaller scale incidents that often got little or no attention. Mark found the way government tracks gun violence was also spotty.
I sometimes think some states' crime reports are run through the Tourism Bureau before they make it out to the public. If something happens in one town 25 miles away, nobody will know about it.
So a few years ago, he launched the Gun Violence Archive with funding from a Washington philanthropist named Mike Klein. It's an online database that tracks gun incidents from across the country and makes that information quickly available to the public. Each day, Mark's researchers comb thousands of websites, news outlets, reports from police and coroner's offices. The archive tracks all sorts of incidents, like crimes involving stolen weapons.
People don't realize that there are 250,000 guns stolen every year. That's 250,000 guns that ends up on the street.
Mark also tallies accidental shootings, child gunshot victims, and times when guns are used to intimidate but aren't actually fired. His archive is closely followed by the media, academic researchers, and some law enforcement agencies. In 2015, it recorded some 53,000 incidents that resulted in more than 13,000 deaths. Mark says the costs go far beyond human lives.
Gun violence costs billions of tax dollars in added police, in emergency rooms, in loss of wages, loss of taxes with wages. The cost is just mind-numbing.
Mark hoped his database would help policymakers craft gun laws that could save lives. But in America, you can't wade into the numbers without also wading into the intense politics of guns. We got a taste of that last year at a fancy ballroom in Nashville, Tennessee, on the eve of the National Rifle Association's annual meeting. It was a fundraiser for the Crime Prevention Research Center, a group whose work supports some of the NRA's most popular slogans.
More guns equals less crime. Fewer guns is a murderer's dream.
That's Ted Nugent, the rocker and longtime NRA board member. He's a big star on the gun circuit, outspoken, sometimes outrageous. Ted's wearing a camouflage jacket and cap, and he's speaking to about 100 people. They're dressed in everything from suits and fancy dresses to jeans and cowboy boots.
I know some of you have family members that are anti-gun. Fix them. I know you have coworkers that don't like guns and don't like the NRA. Fix them. Hammer the living out of them every day with statistics. John's got the statistics.
Ted's talking about John Lott, He's a controversial economist who founded the Research Center a few years ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, John Lott.
This is his event.
What I say, after you listen to Ted, it's kind of like anything is anticlimactic.
John's best-known book, More Guns, Less Crime, has been widely challenged by some academic researchers, but it's a Bible for the gun rights movement.
We had a survey that came out showing that the vast majority of economists think that having guns make people safer.
John Lott couldn't be more different from Mark Bryant. John is skinny and bookish. He's ambivalent about owning guns himself, but is a big ally of the NRA. And he's dismissive of Mark's gun violence archive.
I don't think he's doing a very good job.
He says even the very phrase, gun violence, ignores the benefits of guns.
Guns make it easier for bad things to happen, there's no doubt about that. But they also make it easier for people to protect themselves and prevent bad things from happening.
According to John Lott, people use guns to stop crimes all the time. It's just that it doesn't show up in databases or in media and police reports. But he says that if you look at surveys of crime victims,
you're going to get like five times or so the rate that people use guns defensively as compared to using guns in the commission of crimes.
This is known as defensive use, and it's a big deal in the gun rights movement. If you do the math, what John is saying is that guns are used in self-defense more than a million times each year. Mark Bryant says that if that were the case, his researchers would know about it.
The logic that they use that says, well, most of them just aren't reported, we just walk away happy that we kicked ass, that's baloney. That says that we took the law in our own hands and did not think there was a need to inform of a crime that occurred that escalated to the point that we needed a gun.
Mark's gun violence archive documented just 1,300 cases of people using guns defensively in 2015. And while Mark says the actual number is probably a little higher, it's still a tiny fraction of the figures claimed by John Lott. And this isn't just an abstract debate about statistics. John Lott's research is used to back laws, making it easier to carry concealed weapons.
When you pass right-to-carry laws, as the percentage of the population with permits increases, you see drops in violent crimes. Some criminals stop committing crimes. Some criminals switch into other types of crimes. And some criminals move to other areas.
He wants us to believe that there is a direct cause and effect.
Mark Bryant says data on gun violence doesn't support John's claims about the benefits of concealed carry laws.
At one point, he was clamoring that Chicago's gun deaths were down because of the new concealed carry law in Illinois. Well, the law had been in existence for about 30 days. Too many times, folks will tailor the data to suit their message that they already have.
Even though Mark says the gun lobby is wrong about the number of crimes stopped by firearms, it doesn't seem to matter. John's side is winning. All you have to do is look at the number of laws that allow more people to carry guns. More than 36 states have now passed concealed carry legislation or loosened existing laws, according to advocates on both sides of the debate. And just in the past decade, the number of permits has nearly tripled to more than 13 million. When it comes to tailoring gun data, Mark says the NRA and its allies are the biggest offenders. But he says liberal groups sometimes do it too. One example, Every Town for Gun Safety. That's the group funded by former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Mark says Every Town has inflated the number of school shootings by including incidents that don't involve students or staff.
Two guys meet at the parking lot that happens to belong to a school at 3 in the morning to exchange drugs or guns or girls or whatever, and gunfire comes into play. That's not really a school shooting. I think the idea is that if 12 is bad, then 23's a lot worse.
We contacted Every Town, and a representative told us they stand by their numbers. Mark Bryant says his archive is nonpartisan, but his private views lean toward gun violence prevention groups. He believes in tighter background checks and better ways to store guns safely. Still, some people on the liberal side of the fence don't know what to make of Mark.
I think that there are times when a minority of people in the push for gun reform will wonder what he's all about. You know, who is this Mark Bryant from Kentucky who owns a lot of guns and sticks up for gun people, he's not our kind.
Amanda Gailey is a member of Nebraskans Against Gun Violence. She's friendly with Mark and relies on his database to track local gun violence.
You know, it takes a while to realize that he's exactly the kind of person we need in the gun reform push. He's fact-based, fact-driven.
And the facts assembled in the gun violence archive underscore the urgency of the issue. Last year alone, more than 3,300 children in America were killed or wounded by guns.
You're just seeing a constant grind of pain.
Pain that sometimes hits home. Mark had to hire a trauma counselor to work with his staff. Recently, one researcher quit her job. It was all just too much.
I believe it was an infant that was shot and killed, and that took her over the edge. When I was starting this in 13, I could remember the name of every victim. I knew how old they were. I could remember their photographs that were in the newspapers. And now I cannot do that. And that's a good thing. I've detached from that. It's bad that there has been so many of them that have just calloused me, but that's where it is.
Our story was produced by Reveal's Michael Montgomery and co-reported by Matt Drange. In the interest of full disclosure, we should mention that the brother of one of our producers is a staffer at Everytown for Gun Safety. That's the gun control group funded by Michael Bloomberg. People on both sides of the debate say they want to see fewer deaths and injuries by guns. Next, a high-tech system that listens for gunshots and directs police to the scene. But does it catch the bad guys? That's coming up next on Reveal.
Hi there, podcast listeners. Julia B. Chan here. We're spending the hour talking about the toll of gun violence in the country. As Reveal's digital editor, I'm reminded of a number of stories about the manufacturing, regulation, and trafficking of these weapons. Like how we found hundreds of gun parts on sale on eBay despite the auction site's firearm policy. Or the time we exposed loopholes in California's treatment of concealed carry permits. If you want to read these stories and more, go to revealnews.org/guns for our cache of gun stories.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Today, we're looking at guns in America through data and statistics. Police departments across the country are looking for ways to curb gun violence. Typically, police first learn about a shooting from a 911 call. In many cases, the caller doesn't know exactly what happened.
And the car that's parked in front of 1901 Palou has glass all over it.
Did he shoot the vehicle?
I don't know. I didn't see that part. I saw him go back into the property with a gun.
Okay, and where's this guy now?
Still in the property, I believe.
In this case, San Francisco police arrived before the woman could even finish the call.
Yeah, I'm talking to a police captain right now. Do I need to talk to you too?
You're speaking with the police?
I have a police captain in front of me,
okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead and speak.
Police found out about the shooting because of something called ShotSpotter. It's a gunshot detection technology that's supposed to help law enforcement reduce gun crime. ShotSpotter is used in about 90 cities across the country. It's even installed in schools, and it's costing taxpayers millions of dollars each year. We wanted to know what the police and the public are getting in return. Reveal's Matt Drange brings us this story.
The way it works is simple. A series of sensors, think big, sensitive microphones, are installed around a city. Rooftops, street lamps, the higher up the better. The sensors are always on, always listening. Here's what a ShotSpotter alert sounds like. When three or more sensors detect possible gunshots, ShotSpotter plots them on a map and notifies police dispatchers. The way San Francisco officials talk about it, you'd think the technology has revolutionized their approach to fighting gun crime.
ShotSpotter has helped us because we know that we have forensic evidence that we can rely upon in proving that a shooting did or did not take place.
That's San Francisco's Assistant District Attorney Diana Garcia. She's speaking in a promotional video ShotSpotter produced a couple years ago. Garcia was joined by an official from the mayor's office and San Francisco Police Chief Greg Sir.
They say number one thing that reduces crime, the fear of being caught, well, we're catching the bad guys.
San Francisco first installed the technology back in 2008. Since then, police have expanded the system to cover 13 square miles, costing taxpayers more than $2.6 million. To hear ShotSpotter in action, I went on a ride-along with police in the Bayview neighborhood. The community has struggled to combat gun violence for years and was the first to get the technology. I hop in the back of a squad car on a recent Friday night. It didn't take long for the first ShotSpotter alert to come crackling over the radio. We zoom through the streets of San Francisco, blowing through intersections. The officers hunt for the quickest route to the scene.
To the right.
Towards Indian?
Yeah.
In about 2 minutes, we get to where ShotSpotter pinpointed the gunfire, but we don't find anything. The officers ask bystanders for clues.
Hey, boss, you hear anything like a gunshot?
Did you hear any gunshots at all?
Any cars flying out of here?
No, one man says. I just got here.
Okay.
At this point, it's clear that we're in the wrong place. The shooting happened half a mile away, where other officers responding to 911 calls are already interviewing witnesses and collecting shell casings. We clear out.
The ShotSpotter at 1407 Caesar have been found.
Calls like this one are not unusual. ShotSpotter gives the wrong location up to 20% of the time. It's especially a problem near big hills and downtown areas with tall buildings. Even when the technology does give police an accurate starting point, they often come up empty-handed. We dug into every ShotSpotter alert police responded to in San Francisco over a 2.5-year period, beginning in January 2013. That's more than 3,000 calls altogether. In nearly 2/3 of the calls, police couldn't locate evidence of gunshots. And in those 2.5 years of data that we sifted through, police made just 2 arrests. One of the arrests that came from a ShotSpotter notification had nothing to do with guns. When officers responded to an alert in August 2014, they didn't find a shooter. They didn't find shell casings either, or witnesses. What they found was a drunk man with an outstanding warrant. His arrest was attributed to ShotSpotter in police records. So what about the other arrest, the one that involved a gun? Let's go back to the shooting you heard at the beginning of the story.
I have a police captain in front of me, yeah.
Go ahead and speak to the police.
Okay, so, round the corner here at 1901.
Yeah. San Francisco Police Commander Rob O'Sullivan responded to the scene that morning and interviewed the 911 caller. ShotSpotter alerted him to the location before it went out over the police radio. As O'Sullivan walked across the street, he found shattered glass surrounding a green minivan riddled with bullet holes.
And just as I made the corner, I looked down the street and I saw a gentleman that was, he was actually sitting on the sidewalk. And he matched the description. It was all dark clothing.
There was the shooter, a man named Marlon Fajardo. Rather than run away, he sat on the sidewalk in front of his house. He lives next door to the neighbor whose car he admitted to shooting up.
More often than not, somebody that fires a gun isn't going to stick around, just to see what happens. You know, more often than not, they're in a car, they're on foot, and they're running or they're driving away.
Do you think the outcome would have been different had ShotSpotter not been installed in this case?
You know, that's hard to say. In this case, the suspect sat down on the sidewalk, so he made the decision not to leave.
This was an easy case for police. It was also an exceptional one. Fajardo wasn't caught because of ShotSpotter. He was arrested because he stayed at the scene of the crime.
Our expectation isn't that every time there's a ShotSpotter alert that someone will dispatch that particular scene and actually catch a criminal with a gun in their hand, although that has happened.
That's Ralph Clark, the president and CEO of ShotSpotter. He says rather than catch a shooter when responding to ShotSpotter alerts, police are more likely to find gunshot victims. And we found a handful of cases where that has happened. Ralph lives in an affluent neighborhood of Oakland. He keeps a ShotSpotter sensor on the roof of his home, but it almost never goes off. And the rare times it does detect gunfire, Ralph says police are likely to get multiple 911 calls. But that's not always what happens. In some neighborhoods, where gun violence is more common, less than 20% of suspected gunfire is reported to police.
That means 80 to 90% of the time, people don't call 911. That's a problem. That's a problem that we fundamentally fix.
Ralph says ShotSpotter can also play a role in helping police collect evidence that prosecutors can use to get convictions.
It enables cops to get the dots, get out of their car. They're oftentimes recovering shell casings, which then can lead to downstream cases being made.
Here's the catch. That rarely happens, either in San Francisco or other cities with ShotSpotter. The San Francisco DA's office was unable to find any convictions where the technology played a major role. At first, they couldn't point us to any cases at all. After weeks of back and forth, a spokesman for the office found a handful of cases where ShotSpotter played a part. But many of the cases were older, and the technology only played a minor role. So I went back to San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr. I asked him to explain why he continues to tout ShotSpotter, despite the fact that it rarely puts police in a position to catch the bad guys.
Well, I mean, anecdotally, we put ShotSpotter where we believed and or knew where we were having disproportionate gun violence. I can't give you a concrete example, but I know it's a nice technology to have.
The chief struggles to come up with specific cases involving ShotSpotter. He's quick to point out that in the 5 years since he took over the department, most gun crime is down. That's true. In big cities across the country, gun crime is down. But it's the same in cities that have never tried ShotSpotter.
And so I'm just trying to make sense of, like, you have this technology. It's in place in more than 90 cities, right? San Francisco is one of them. But what concrete are we as the public sort of getting in return for that?
20 less homicides a year and 50% less shootings for the overall strategy that we employ that includes technology that ShotSpotter's part of.
Right, that ShotSpotter's a part of. So that's what I'm trying to separate from this thing, is what can you actually, like, point to ShotSpotter and say, yes, that helped us with X or Y or Z? Because so far, it's like the evidence just isn't really there.
We have an overall strategy. Technology's part of it. We have 20 less homicides a year.
That's as far as the chief will go. Even though there's no concrete link between ShotSpotter and the general decrease in violent crime, he believes having the technology is worth the cost. While San Francisco is sticking with ShotSpotter, others are bailing out. At least five cities have let their contracts with ShotSpotter run out. In Charlotte, North Carolina, police plan to use the money they saved to install more surveillance cameras, a technology that's proven successful. Major Steve Willis of the Charlotte Police Department said ShotSpotter simply wasn't helping them fight gun crime.
So once we started looking at it, yes, we were seeing positives in the fact that we were getting more calls created for gunfire. However, we were having a hard time being able to show that data that we had actually arrested individuals who were responsible for the gunfire in which the calls were generated for.
Charlotte wasn't alone. The city of Quincy, Washington, also abandoned the technology. I went to Quincy and spoke to their mayor, Jim Hembury, about that decision.
My expectation was we'd have this map and we'd be able to say, wow, you know, we don't have gunfire incidents over here and we don't have them here, but boy, we have a lot of them here. So now we can concentrate on patrolling that area more rigorously. And that, for whatever reason, never came to fruition.
Quincy is a rural farming community about 3 hours east of Seattle. It's the smallest town in the country to install ShotSpotter. A few years ago, Mayor Hembury and his police chief thought the technology could help them tackle a flare-up of gang violence. And it did. Once. ShotSpotter helped police investigate what they call their own OK Corral shooting. It happened down the street from the police station. One night, a half dozen rival gang members got into a shootout. Police used ShotSpotter to figure out which side fired first, allowing them to recreate what happened. But that one success wasn't enough. Quincy decided to ditch the technology in late 2013, less than a year and a half after they rolled it out.
You know, ultimately it came down to a decision of, yeah, do you want to keep this system or do you want to hire another police officer? And from the public's perspective, they would much rather have boots on the ground than this acoustical system.
The problem in Quincy and other cities that abandoned ShotSpotter isn't that the technology doesn't work. Most of the time, it does. The problem is there's little evidence that the technology is helping law enforcement reduce gun crime, even in cities that are renewing their contracts. We collected dispatch records, ShotSpotter alert data, and thousands of pages of police records from more than two dozen cities around the country. A clear pattern emerged. Lots of calls, but few results. In Milwaukee and Kansas City, for example, police spent thousands of hours responding to ShotSpotter alerts, yet they made arrests only about 1% of the time. ShotSpotter claims its data has been accepted by courts as evidence in 17 states. But when I spoke with prosecutors around the country, They told me ShotSpotter usually plays a minor role in closing cases. At this point, you might be thinking, how does ShotSpotter continue selling its technology with so few tangible results? A lot of it has to do with effective marketing.
It's time to fight back with a proven force multiplier that's operationally effective and cost-effective. It's time to fight back with ShotSpotter.
The company produces sophisticated promotional videos, like the one that included the San Francisco police chief. The ads feature confidence-inspiring phrases and promise results, such as better community relations and enhanced situational awareness.
ShotSpotter, the critical first step in stopping gun violence.
But those results are hard to measure. I asked ShotSpotter CEO Ralph Clark to explain the technology's value. He wasn't armed with hard numbers or specific cases. Instead, he spoke more generally about ShotSpotter's role in violent neighborhoods where sensors detect gunfire daily.
What we're about is, in our highest and best use, we say of our system, is to provide a higher level of service to underserved communities around the issues of gun violence. Show up, be present, get at it, knock on doors, ask if people are okay. That's huge.
Another reason for ShotSpotter's dominance. The company controls its image by preventing data from being released to the public. This includes even basic information about when and where gunshots are fired.
We own the data, and we license the data on an annual subscription basis to the agency.
Most police departments that use ShotSpotter lease the equipment. This saves cities money, but it also means the police don't own the data. ShotSpotter does. When we requested basic information to map gunfire in cities, ShotSpotter fired back. The company sent out a nationwide memo to customers, claiming the data was exempt from public records laws. They argued it was a trade secret.
From an independent journalistic standpoint, it makes it very hard to sort of measure or quantify effectiveness when you can't get the data. And some cities have taken that position with their state law.
Yeah, I mean, and so, yeah, you know, hey, bad for you. Really sorry about that. Good for the overall system, because now we can charge an affordable price to agencies that we otherwise wouldn't do it. Because if we didn't have the big data play, we'd be charging a very different price.
The big data play Clark is talking about is a gamble ShotSpotter is betting on big time. The idea is to convince the FBI or ATF to buy its data wholesale. Clark worries that if cities release the information, ShotSpotter won't be able to sell it later. The vast majority of ShotSpotter customers have never analyzed their data to find out if the technology is helping them reduce gun crime. Instead, police departments rely on the company to tell them how they're doing. This works out well for ShotSpotter. San Francisco's contract is up at the end of the year. Chief Sir doesn't hesitate when I ask if he plans to renew it.
You could imagine what someone might say if all of a sudden, because of money, you stop doing something. This is San Francisco, right? We're the technology hub of the world. So for us to not have the best technology available, especially when it comes to keeping people safe, would be irresponsible of us to do.
And it's not just San Francisco. Most cities are renewing their contracts, and new ones continue to sign up. ShotSpotter dominates this market all by itself, having bought out the competition years ago.
Our story was produced by Matt Drange, with reporting from Ali Winston. At its current pace, ShotSpotter will have sensors in more than 100 cities before the end of the year. When we come back, we'll go to a city that's looking for people most likely to commit a crime with a gun and giving them reason not to pull the trigger. This is Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Byer Duncan here, Reveal's community manager. I wanted to remind you to check out our Instagram account. It's where we file visual dispatches from our investigations every week. You'll get a chance to put a face to many of the characters you hear on the show, like Father Bill Terry, who maintains the murder board you heard about earlier. You'll also catch glimpses of our reporters in action, digging up secret documents and exploring far-off places. If you're listening on your phone right now, you're just a few taps away. So check it out. In the Instagram app, just search @Reveal.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. This week, we're looking at how data and statistics are being used to reduce the number of gun-related crimes in America. For the past 9 years, Richmond, California has experimented with an unconventional approach. Using data from law enforcement and community members, it identifies young men most likely to shoot someone or get shot and targets them, but not for surveillance or punishment. Instead, these individuals are singled out for mentoring and money. Now, cities across the country, including Oakland, California, and Washington, D.C., are considering launching similar programs. Suki Lewis of KQED brings us this story from Richmond.
This is kind of a funny question. Do you have a favorite tattoo? I'm seeing all your tattoos on your arm.
Yeah, I got my mother's portrait on this arm.
Yeah, she's beautiful. What's her name?
Laverne.
LaVon Carter's right knee bounces a little nervously as we talk. I tell him he looks younger than his 27 years.
And you've got just the one kid?
Yeah, I just got one.
LaVon grew up on the south side of Richmond, a small city just northeast of San Francisco, and behind bars.
I was incarcerated for my 14th birthday, 15th birthday. Then from 20 to 25, I was in prison.
And how did you end up incarcerated? Was it drugs or?
It was drugs and pimping. I mean, you never see anybody else making money any other way.
While LaVon was in prison, most of his friends were also disappearing from the streets of his neighborhood.
They did, basically. Almost all of them. I probably got two people. Now that I think about it, two people that I grew up with, yeah, everybody else, they gone.
When LaVon came home from federal prison 3 years ago, he needed to make money. And he heard about this kind of crazy program that sounded like an easy way to bring in some cash.
I'm like, cool, if I could get paid to do that, why not?
For the city, it started as a big experiment, says Richmond Mayor Tom Butt.
Going into it, I think it was, you know, it was kind of a wait and see. We didn't know whether it was going to work or not, but we were sort of desperate.
This was back in 2007 when Butt was a council member. That year, there were 47 homicides in the city. That's almost 10 times the national murder rate. The city was ready to try something new. Devone Bogan, this youth mentor from Oakland, proposed this: create a city office of neighborhood safety that would seek out the young men most likely to shoot someone or get shot and give them a reason to put down their guns.
We're the only agency in the city of Richmond that is engaging the one percenters, those individuals who are the most lethal young men in our city who continue to walk our street.
Bogan's office pays young guys like LaVon up to $1,000 a month not to get involved in the violence that surrounds them. While some critics don't love the idea of giving money to potentially lethal young men, Bogan says his approach is a lot cheaper than someone getting shot and killed.
The stipend is a gesture of saying, you are valuable. Your expertise is valuable. Your contribution to this work of creating a healthier city is valuable. Hell, we should be giving you more.
But Bogan says the money, which comes from private grants rather than public funds, is actually secondary. The program works because of guys like Sam Vaughn, who goes out into Richmond's poorest and most violent neighborhoods every day to meet guys like LaVon where they live.
Well, the first thing you do is you gotta identify with them. You gotta speak to something that they can identify with, something that they can acknowledge. And first thing is like, life sucks. Their life sucks. And just acknowledge that. And I know it sucks, but it doesn't have to.
They keep you on track.
For LaVon, the constant connection, the constant checking in made all the difference. A program he'd gone into for the money was now actually changing his life.
The fact that you can just be real with and tell them everything that's going on and know that they're there to try to help you, not trying to influence you to go do some dumb stuff, you know what I mean?
LaVon says Sam helped him come up with a life plan and carry it out. He's got a 3-year-old son and makes good money now as a heavy equipment operator.
Thanks for sharing your story with me.
No problem. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
The National Council on Crime and Delinquency evaluated the program last year and found most of the guys who made it through the fellowship are like LaVon. They're getting their lives together. And perhaps most importantly, they're alive. But even with the success of the fellowship, young people in Richmond are still getting shot. After the city's homicide rate hit a three-decade low in 2014, violent crime is up again.
Next on the agenda is open forum. Tonight we have 23 speakers.
At a recent city council meeting, a 15-year-old girl approaches the podium. Around her neck hang laminated photos of three young guys, her friends, who'd all been shot in the past 2 weeks.
My name is Ajane Hughes. I'm from Richmond, California. I'm only 15 and I've been to more funerals than I can count. I'm tired of going to funerals. I'm tired of saying RIP. I'm tired of having to go on Facebook and see, oh, 14 years old, dead. Oh, dead behind the school, dead in a freeway. It's crazy. Enough is enough. Somebody got to say something, because if they not, I will.
Richmond police say they're responding to the violence by putting more patrols on the streets. But Captain Mark Gagan says law enforcement can't do it alone.
People should look to the police for some answers, but we also need the community, the nonprofits, the faith-based community, everybody to be there with us.
Devone Bogan says the Office of Neighborhood Safety constantly has to adapt to changes on the street. Right now, he's seeing younger victims and shooters. He says reaching teens is difficult because their brains simply haven't developed yet, and many are hopeless.
Hey, I heard one of these young men, and I think this is important, say, and I believed he meant it, and believed it, not just meant it, he believed it, when I asked him, you know, why do you shoot? Because when I do, I matter.
And that's the challenge to guys like Sam, who, regardless of homicide rates or crime stats, goes out every day to try to touch these young people.
As long as there's a young person who has that option or the opportunity to live a healthy, successful life, and he's making decisions that can take that away from him, we need to be here, and we need to be as diligent as if we had 10,000 young people that we were working with.
That story was from Suki Lewis of KQED in San Francisco. If kids could be shown a path away from guns and violence, how much better off Richmond and so many other cities might be? Which brings us back to Father Bill Terry at St. Anna's Church in New Orleans. We met Father Bill at the beginning of the show when he told us about the Murder Board, a memorial he created for those in his community who lost their lives to violence. Father Bill is also focusing his energies on the living, specifically on young people in the Treme neighborhood, many of whom have had their own close encounters with guns. Here's Deacon Joyce Jackson.
It's an ongoing thing. My grandkids already know when they hear gunfire hit the floor, and or wherever we are. One time we were standing, we were getting in the car, and we had to drop down to the ground.
What Father Bill and his church came up with is called Anna's Place, a program for kids in kindergarten through eighth grade.
So we started this program. We now have an enrollment of about 60 children. We are blessed to be partnered with the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra and New Orleans Museum of Art because we use music to teach mathematics, English, composition, ecology, and physics. All of those things are found in music, believe it or not.
Desiree, what does the F mean?
Forte.
Very good. Anaya, what does MP mean?
Metro piano.
Very good.
Every day after school and on Saturdays, students come to classrooms next to St. Anna's Church to help with homework, take classes in entrepreneurship, and also attend a healthcare program. A lot of these kids knew people whose names were on the murder board, like 10-year-old Darielle.
One of them was a family member, which is my mom's boyfriend who got killed. And one of them on the board is my friend's sister. She was a twin. She was pregnant.
13-year-old Iman has been coming to Anna's Place for 2 years. He says he rarely gets into trouble, but he's seen a change in other kids who normally do.
So it really helps kids, and it changes their mindset.
Like, some kids are usually just bad before they come here, and after like a year or so, they change. Like, they're not as bad as they were when they came here when they first started.
Think about it. If you have 60 students and out of that, you have positive impact on, let's say, 30 students. 30 students each have two kids. So now you're talking about, you know, 60, and it becomes exponential growth of creating solid middle-class values of virtue, of independence, of self-respect, of self-reliance.
Looking out over his neighborhood, Father Bill says it will probably take 10 years to see the changes he's hoping for. But he's already encouraged that he's on the right track.
Every day when I get ready to go home in the evening, I get, you know, Talia or Anaya or some other cute little kid that's about 3 feet tall run up to me and give me a huge hug around the waist. You know, these kids just want to go someplace where they're going to be loved, maybe pampered a little bit, mostly given some attention.
That again was Father Bill Terry of St. Anna's Episcopal Church in New Orleans. Michael Montgomery was our lead producer this week, and Taki Telenese edited our show. Julia B. Chan produced our digital content. Thanks to the folks at KQED in San Francisco, including Suki Lewis, Mia Zuckerkandel, Julia McElvoy, and Holly Kernan. Special thanks to Jacob Lewis. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our editor-in-chief is Amy Powell. Krista Scharfenberg is our head of studio. Suzanne Reber is Reveal's executive editor. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camerato, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Edson, and remember, there is always more to the story.